Wonderful. Thanks, you guys. Let's do a little housekeeping. Let's move this out of the way because I might hit it otherwise because I'm a walker. We'll put it back when you're supposed to ask questions. All right. I want to start by asking you all a question. Because in the current media cycle that we've been in, there's been a lot of news about the Horn of Africa, especially this past fall and the winter, because of the famine in Somalia and the food crisis elsewhere. So my question, is that a tragedy or is it an opportunity?
Yes.
Both. Yes. I like the yes answer. Both. Why both?
Mm-hmm. Opportunity to help, opportunity to understand, opportunity to broaden your horizons. It's just lots of opportunities.
So he said that it's a tragedy because it's frankly a tragedy, but it's an opportunity to help because it's an opportunity to understand, to broaden your horizons, to actually dig deeper into that. So what we're going to do tonight is we're going to focus specifically on Ethiopia, one country in the Horn of Africa that I have fallen in love with. And this is not juvenile love. This is married love. Flaws and possibilities revealed to both of us. And then some more flaws and some more possibilities. I'm going to tell you guys three stories tonight that I guarantee are going to change the way you think about Ethiopia, Africa, and your role in the world. So we have a lot to do, and I can speak really quickly. So we're in good shape. First, I want to introduce you to Marsha Ade, his wife Gete Tebo, and six of their seven children. Marsha Ade is the tribal leader of the Mesa tribe, seven generations back in his family. He lives on the flanks of Mount Urawalo. I traveled for 2 days by car and another day by car and foot to find Marsha Ade. But I didn't know I was looking for him. I was looking for the best storyteller. I've spent years in Ethiopia asking people, tell me who your best storyteller is. Who's the best storyteller in your family, in your tribe, in your community? Who will tell me the stories that your grandmother would blush about? Who would tell me the stories that I, a foreigner, a white girl who grew up in Minnesota in the States, am not supposed to know? And in the Amaro Mountains, everyone said I had to find Marsha Ade. This is a landscape that is lush and verdant and green. It's crazy. There are coffee trees here that are as tall as a two-story building. There are just verdant false banana trees, which have these leaves that are almost the size of kind of twice of what a banana leaf would be. And everything is just reminding you of opulence in this land in the Amaro Mountains. Marsha Ade knew I was coming before I knew who he was, because he lives in a home without a door. That's what signifies his status as a leader of the Mesa tribe. So he was ready for me before I even knew who I was going to talk to. An hour before, he'd spotted me down there, and he knew with conviction that he was the person that I was coming for. Marsha Ade lives in an incredibly rural part of Ethiopia. This is a part of the world where, like most people, he is a farmer, and he's a coffee farmer. He makes less than a dollar a day. That's a standard wage in Ethiopia. But Marsha Ade drinks a fortune every day in coffee. Consider this. Coffee is so plentiful here that people don't just have coffee trees in their backyard, they have coffee forests in their backyard. And they drink coffee and they consume it so much so that if he was getting top market prices for his coffee, he would drink $75 a day in coffee. That's a four-month income that he's drinking in his coffee a day. So is Marsha Ade rich by those standards? Or is he poor? He's rich. It depends on how we look at it. Coffee did not come here from humans in Ethiopia. It came from nature. Wef Zerash, natural seed dispersal by birds, by monkeys, that sort of movement. But in the Amaro Mountains, there's a legend that Marsha Ade shared with me, because coffee started being consumed in Ethiopia 3,000 years ago, the time of the Queen of Sheba, if you listen to legend. But the Mesa tribe didn't start consuming it until the 19th century. And here's the reason. They were convinced that these bright red coffee cherries, which is the way a coffee cherry looks when you're supposed to pick it when it's ripe, they thought it would burn them. And it wasn't until Muslim traders came from Kureta on camels and traded them for this coffee took it away by the capfuls on these camels, that they began to think differently about it. But here's the clincher. It wasn't until these same traders would return unburned that they believed that it was safe to consume the coffee. Marsha Day told me this while we were looking at these bright, succulent red coffee cherries from his trees. So how many people in this room have tasted a fresh coffee cherry? All right, so for those of you who have, what does it taste like?
Not coffee.
Not coffee. Does it taste, what does it taste like instead?
I don't know,
not coffee. It's sort of like a fruit, right? Like you bite into that juicy outside, and then inside there's a seed, and it's kind of, it's sort of like a, sort of like halfway between a raisin and a grape, if that makes any sense, you know, but a little bit harder too, and it kind of gets stuck in your teeth. The coffee that we're used to seeing, if we're going to buy coffee, the way those seeds are, that's half. That's, ooh, the laser pointer does not work on the television, which is a good thing to know. So that's half of this. And what happens normally is that those are doubled, and then they're encased in a bunch of different linings, and then you have the outer cherry. But these things are kind of lush. They pop in your mouth. They're sticky, and they're sweet. And I'm eating this cherry from Marsha Ade's trees, and I'm thinking, wow, this is, you know, this could be the best coffee in the world. And the reason I'm thinking this is because Marsha Ade is telling me with conviction that his coffee is the best in the world. I've never met anyone in Ethiopia who thinks differently about their coffee, ever. Marsha Ade and I, at that point, had been talking for about an hour, and we both talk with our hands a lot. So the translator, because there's 200 dialects in Ethiopia, it's impossible for me to be fluent in any of them, or one of them, you know, the translator that I'm working with has now gotten out of the way because we keep hitting him with our hands, because Marsha Ade and I are leaning towards each other trying to have this conversation. And pretty soon, the one phrase in English that he can say is, my coffee is the best in the world, because he's heard it translated that much. Coffee topples over itself in these mountains, but as Marsha Ade says, there's no way for it to leave the trees because there's just too much coffee. When the coffee does get picked, it gets consumed on the spot or it gets thrown into a vat and combined in Arbaminch, about a half day's drive away. I spent 4 days in the Amara Mountains, never saw another car. The roads that are there are used for flat surfaces for drying coffee because that's where you can access the most sun. We were there, and Marsha Ade, he's telling me he has the best coffee, and we're tasting this, and he says, oh, you know, I can prove this to you because coffee is the thing that puts our country on the map. But no one had ever interviewed him about coffee before. No one had ever interviewed any of his ancestors about coffee before. But he knew this. And by this time, we were pretty good friends. So it's about 4 p.m, and the clouds are building in Ethiopia. And he says, you know, I want to celebrate because this is the first time a foreigner has come to talk to me about coffee. So I want to kill an ox for you. And I thought, well, you know, it's 4 p.m, and that tends to take about 4 hours. I've seen it happen, and I don't really know if that's going to work. And we both thought that it might be a little too extravagant for the night. So we came up with another plan. He was going to do a dance for me. He was going to go put on his traditional tribal costume and do a dance. So here's his dance. This is his pre-coffee dance. Imagine post-coffee dance. Okay? So he invited me into his home to see that because we thought that if we can't kill an ox and slaughter it and cherish that animal and cherish this time together, we're going to go have coffee. And I walk into the earthen home and Gete Teba has already been starting a coffee ceremony. So she has been roasting the green coffee on an open fire on a flat pan, and you can start smelling the aromas, the sweet and citrus smell of coffee roasting, and she roasts it expertly. She pulls it off the fire. She puts frankincense and myrrh on those coals, so suddenly you have those aromas mixing with the coffee, and your stomach is just growling, and I thought, wow, it's growling really loud, and I realized, no, that's thunder in the background, so we have thunder and my stomach growling at this point, and I think, oh, this is going to be amazing. So then she pours these roasted coffee beans into a mortar and pestle, and she pulverizes them in about 5 minutes. It takes me about an hour to pulverize beans like that. And the women in Ethiopia, I don't know how many years I have to start work. I have to work in Ethiopia, but it's going to be probably another 4 decades of my life before I can get to that level of skill. Then she pours those grounds into a jebena, a thick-bellied, narrow-necked pot, and she puts water in it and puts it back on the coals, and suddenly it smells like that sweet, sticky coffee. And I think this could be it. This could be the best coffee in the world. This could be the coffee that gets $150 a pound. But then that thunder roars again, and I take the deepest breath I can, and I run for all it's worth to escape the largest flash flood I've ever seen in Ethiopia. I never had that coffee. The flash flood did not hurt anyone. It's important to tell you because other audience have asked me that. But it was incredible. We could barely get out of there the next day. It was just turned everything into a bit of a mudslide. I one day will go have Marsha Day's coffee because he's on the cover of my book. And I can't wait to go and honor him with a book where he and his family are standing there being who they are on the cover of this. 70% of Ethiopia is lush, forested, perfect topography for coffee. Thick volcanic soil, between 2,000 and 8,000 square feet, 2,000 and 8,000 feet in elevation. The rest of Ethiopia, the images we always see, dry, flat, barren, that's a third of Ethiopia, and even less. All of this is Ethiopia. This is where humanity began 4 million years ago. And if you listen to legend, coffee started right after that. There are 10,000 varieties of coffee in Ethiopia. 10,000 varieties. We're in San Francisco. We're right in the heart of the wine land, right? Raise your hand if you've been to Napa. All right, thank you. So think of coffee like wine. What if you went to the most amazing restaurant in San Francisco and you got a wine list that had 10,000 different types on it? That's what Ethiopia has to offer the coffee world. This is the birthplace of coffee Arabica. Coffee Arabica is a horrible name for coffee that originated in Ethiopia. And trust me, most Ethiopians would really love to get that name back. It was named Arabica because the Arabs were the first to cultivate it. Carl Linnaeus, the Swedish creator of taxonomy, made that gaffe, and he's probably rolling around in his grave right now because there's a lot of Ethiopians that would like to kind of wave their stick and say, this is not the way the name is supposed to be. But in the meantime, they have the variety. So in a 1.1 million square kilometer country, twice the size of France or Texas, depending on which place you want to refer to, this is 10,000 types. The terroirs are like wine, all the flavor complexities. So what we need to do in this room today is to move towards an understanding of coffee like wine. Because if we do that, what's going to happen is that we're going to understand that there is incredible potential in Ethiopia for what that complexity can offer a country that's the eighth poorest in the world. It has the greatest supply, the greatest genetic diversity of one of the world's richest crops. If you paid every farmer in Ethiopia 10 cents more for their coffee per pound, Ethiopia would have $60 million additional annual income. But here's the thing. I don't think that's a good idea. I don't think we should pay every farmer who grows coffee in Ethiopia 10 cents more. I think we've tried that. I think that we need to move to a new conversation. I think we need to move to a conversation about quality. I want to see some farmers get 10 cents more, some get $1, some get $2, some get 25 cents. I think we need to start breaking out the nuances, and we can do that if we start looking at these complexities. And we can do that if we tie this back to culture. 1 billion cups of coffee are consumed every day in the world. That statistic is actually from a month ago, so it's probably 1.5 billion now, right? You know, I mean, that's sort of what's happening. So let's make that connection even stronger. And we need to do it because we need to change the effect of these sorts of images. The famine, the food crisis in the Horn of Africa, specifically the famine in Somalia, what people would argue is a famine in Ethiopia, this is what is on the news. This is what's been on the news for the past 6 months. But if you're in Ethiopia, this is not the reality you want to talk about. This is my second book about Ethiopia. And everybody I meet who knows that I'm a writer in Ethiopia, they ask me one question. Are you going to tell a good story or a bad story about my country? This little kid with his homework on his head asked me that question. I was in Seattle a couple months ago giving a talk, and the cab driver who took me to the talk said, oh, so you're writing a book about Ethiopia. Good story or bad story? What's it going to be? Because Ethiopia has been sort of subjugated to this horrible legacy in our global dialogue, drought, famine, poverty, drought, famine, poverty. And what's happening right now is, again, reinvigorating that cycle. So how can we change it? Can we do it with coffee? I think we can. That's my goal for all of us here tonight. Help is complicated when we want it to be simple. So to do this, we're going to have to get complex. Let's take fair trade as an example. Fair trade was an amazing thing when it came to be. It's a really great way. You can go to the store, you can buy something, it can have this nifty little stamp on it, and you can feel better, right? I do it. But the thing is that fair trade doesn't account for the best coffee practices. It's not across the board. It doesn't mean that it's the best coffee. So let's get more complex. We're all pretty intelligent on a global scale. Let's allow for that with how we're going to buy things. Let's ask to get closer to culture and not just have the easy label of fair trade or organic. I think about coffee and I think about the go local movement, right? That's a big thing in the Bay Area, buy local. I don't want coffee from the Bay Area, quite frankly. I want coffee. I want to go to origin. Let's first make sure that some of these crops are getting the rightful, are giving the rightful due to the countries where they're from, especially when you have a country like Ethiopia, which I have said, this is 60% of its foreign earnings, coffee. But yet, it's still the eighth poorest country in the world. We can move that along. All of this came up for me in the same way. I went to Ethiopia my first time wanting to help and realized that it was never going to be as simple as I want it to be. And it started with a free latte. So I was living in Boulder, Colorado, and I was going to my local coffee shop. And there's a guy standing outside of it, and he started whispering to me, which is kind of creepy, right? And he's whispering to me, and he's saying, hey, free coffee across the street. And I was like, yeah, okay. He says, no, free lattes. And I looked at him, and I said, I don't drink lattes. And he said, but it's free. And I was like, that's a really good point. And then, you know, this is when I should fess up to the fact that I'm lactose intolerant. So that's why I don't drink lattes. But I kind of scanned the other side of the street, and I realized that the guy serving the lattes was pretty handsome. So I went across the street, I got myself a latte, and I sat myself just close enough to eavesdrop on the conversation between the handsome man and the owners of the company. Lo and behold, they start talking about going to Ethiopia to try to find the genetic roots of Geisha coffee, which is the coffee at that point that earned the most on the market, $150 to $180 a pound. Then they started talking about the fact that Ethiopia was the birthplace of coffee, something I didn't know at that point. It was so simple. I stood up, I walked over, and I said, do you need a journalist? 3 months later, I was in Ethiopia. When I showed up in Ethiopia, actually we're going to pop back a photo. When I showed up in Ethiopia, I realized that I really understood about 0.003% of the coffee world. And it was overwhelming to me because I wanted these labels like fair trade, organic, local. And that was the context I had. But in Ethiopia, all those were blown out of proportion. I didn't know what to hold on to. So I turned to a part of Ethiopia that I was much more comfortable with. I turned to these sandstone spires in the northern part of the country. Because in my other life, I'm a professional climber. And it's what I do, and it's what I've done for 15 years. So these places seemed way safer to me because the coffee was really overwhelming at that point. But then what happened is I started climbing these sandstone towers. And as it turned out, it was really, really amazing for about 60 feet. And then it was the most horrific and frightening thing I've ever done in my life. Because the sandstone towers of northern Ethiopia, which had up till that point been unclimbed, turns out they were unclimbed because they're not good to climb, not because no one had found them. So I thought this was a great plan to go do first ascents in Ethiopia. And as it turned out, it was one of my worst decisions ever. So here I am, and while this is happening, I've had an Ethiopian publisher approach me, and I had a book deal to write a book about how adventure was going to save Ethiopia. The idea was that by showcasing the adventure potential of this country, that climbers could save Ethiopia, because millions of climbers would flock to Ethiopia. So I got to say there's probably not millions of climbers in the world, and they usually don't like to spend money. So them saving the eighth poorest country in the world, it's a little bit of it's a leap. Let's call it a leap. But I thought it would be a great idea until I got there and I realized, oh, God, this is horrible. And then in the meantime, where I was climbing, this is a tower that we climbed. I keep trying to do that. This is a tower we climbed right here. And at the base of these towers, there's a multi-generational family that included a 13-year-old girl, and that's her four-month-old baby on her back. So how do you tell a story about incredible adventure potential in a country that is just as great as its need for maternal health care? You can't tell the story of one without the other. In order to write that book, I had to stand in a middle place. I had to bring both to bear on that story. And I realized in the process of writing that, that I like that middle place. I think, I've started to think a lot about mental tooth wiggling. So we don't have any kids in this group. We might have some people who are losing their teeth again, but we shouldn't talk about that. So who can remember when you were losing your teeth when you were a kid? What did it feel like? Painful? Scary? Huh? Hopeful. Did it feel kind of good when you would wiggle it? Yeah. Like, did it hurt? Like, I always think that it didn't really hurt. It felt good, right? It was like, yeah, let's do that some more, right? And that's the whole idea that I had to kind of take under while writing that book and then going on a 50-city speaking tour about the process. It's like, we're going to get in the middle, and it's going to hurt, but it's going to feel good. And that's how we're going to do it. And that brought me back to coffee, because I realized that coffee was a thing I chickened out on, right? Coffee was a thing that scared me. And then ironically, I was climbing in Ethiopia, which was way more scary. So I thought, well, let's come back to coffee and let's start telling those stories. We can go to the middle in the way we talk about the Horn of Africa. We can do it with Ethiopia. We can do it with the famine. I am not in any way saying that what's happening with the food crisis in the Horn is not deserving of attention. It deserves a ton of attention. Let's be accurate. Let's talk about the reality. Let's talk about the horror of hunger. Let's talk about the conditions that created it. But then let's also talk about what's happening in these countries that is signifying hope. Because if all we do is talk about the bad, then we're forever conscripting these countries to live in that cycle in a global brand identity. As an example, I work with an amazing company called Imagine One Day, and part of the proceeds from tonight's book, if you guys buy them, go to Imagine One Day. They do sustainable education. Ethiopia has some of the most progressive education reforms happening in Africa. But I will tell you more, but it won't be a Pollyanna Band-Aid to the famine, because that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm saying, let's go to the middle. Let's make it more complicated. We can handle it. I think that's how global conversations get a heck of a lot more interesting. Ethiopia is our reminder. Coffee is our reminder. 1 billion cups of coffee a day. Raise your hand if you drink coffee. For all the people who aren't raising their hand, raise your hand if you see coffee on a daily basis. It's there. It's our reminder. Let's get complicated. Here are the stories to help you remember how to do that. This is Gebru. He lives in northern Ethiopia. When he was a child, he was told that if he drank coffee, he wouldn't make it to paradise. Now, this is a man who lives where the Ark of the Covenant is, in the cradle of civilization, where religion, his religion is infused in everything, the birthplace of coffee. But yet, if he drank coffee, he would not make it to paradise. Evidence came from his parents in the following story. When Jesus died, the world went into mourning. The natural world went into mourning. The rivers, dry. The wind, completely still. Every tree, barren. The only thing that bloomed or blossomed were coffee trees. Coffee was the only plant that didn't cry for Jesus. That's what he told me, while drinking coffee. I said, Gebru, you're drinking coffee. He said, yeah, by the time I got to be 30, you know, things just change, and it just seemed like a good idea to drink coffee. Coffee and religion are intertwined in Ethiopia because culture and religion are intertwined in Ethiopia. As I said, this is a country where you have 70 languages, 200 dialects, so the iterations just keep going and going. In another part of Ethiopia, on the Zege Peninsula, there's a story about a bishop who, when they kind of founded the peninsula in 1307, all of the inhabitants were saying, what are we going to do here? What are we going to grow? And he said, fear not, I have a solution. He took his prayer stick and he broke it in half across his knee and he planted one of them. He broke it again and he planted another stick. So he had three sticks in a row and he said, wait. Everyone came back the next morning and there were three crops growing, coffee, hops, and lemon. He made people promise that those would be the only crops they would ever grow on the Zege Peninsula. More than 700 years later, those are the only crops they grow on the Zege Peninsula. They row them across Lake Tana, close to the birthplace by volume of the Blue Nile, on papyrus boats. These papyrus boats are so strong when they build them with these reeds that they can carry oxen, multiple, on top of them. But then they start to get waterlogged from all of these 7-hour paddles across Lake Tana, so that 3 weeks after the labor goes into building these, the boat is no more. So they pull it up on the shore, they dry the reeds out, and they build another one. And on day one of its life, it can carry an oxen. There's a great story that's very pervasive about the origins of coffee that has to do with a goat. So let's have another show of hands if you've ever heard about a goat and coffee. A couple people. Okay. So the story goes, and I'm going to kind of butcher it a little bit, but the story goes that there's a guy, and his name is Caldy, and he's either a Christian or Muslim. He's a delinquent or a monk. He's a scholar or a prankster, depending on the version. And he notices that these goats he's taking care of are having a really good time. So being like anyone, he thinks, I want to have a good time like the goats. And he goes and finds out that, lo and behold, they're eating coffee. It's a beautiful story. It's everywhere. When Paul Marab from Georgia came to visit Ethiopia in the 1900s, this story was everywhere in Europe. But he couldn't find anyone in Ethiopia who'd ever heard the story. But it was Ethiopia's origin story. Furthermore, the goat story always has its home place in Kaffa. Kaffa sounds a lot like, what other word that we've been using tonight? Coffee. Onomatopoeically, it's a great link, right? It's like, wow, wouldn't that make sense? It's not true. I hate to tell you. The word coffee comes from the Arabic word kawa, which is the word for brew made of a brew, sort of like a wine made from coffee. But that association to kaffa is really, really hardwired into people, as is the goat story. And the thing that you learn in Ethiopia is that origin stories, I mean, you kind of could fly above Ethiopia and you could shoot a bunch of darts down into the country and you get just as many stories that would come at you. And that's the beauty of this country. There's a great story about an olfactorily blessed ox that everyone wanted to smell like, so people started studying what he was eating, and then lo and behold, he ate coffee. There's a story of Prophet Muhammad's grandsons who were being bathed by their mother. And once she was done with her bath, she threw the bathwater out the window, and the next morning, lo and behold, there was a coffee forest there. That story goes back to the 7th century. There's also a great story that this man, Ato Shale, in Sadamo told about coffee being consumed in false banana leaves. Okay, this is not out of context. Think of how big that cup is. Think of how much coffee you could get out of that thing, right? That thing's giant. Ato Shale, he's this wonderful storyteller, and I met him when I was writing this book, and then I returned to Ethiopia this past fall for something like my 8th trip there, and I was leading a group, and I introduced them to Ato Shale. And everyone sat down, and Ato Shale started telling his origin story of coffee. And I found myself being convinced that he had the right story. That's how persuasive he is, strident in his conviction. And it was this moment for me when I realized that that's Ethiopia, the variety of stories that you can have and how people are so hell-bent on saying this is the right story is what makes this place such an interesting place to discover these tales. Throughout Ethiopia, coffee is consumed in a three-part ritual. Coffee represents peace, resolution, luck. It depends on how you drink it to find out what it means. So these cultural identities of coffee, think about sitting down and having not just a quick cup of coffee, but 3 cups of coffee. Thinking about roasting it by hand, grinding it, brewing it, and then going through that process. So Gete Tebo, back in that hut, that coffee I never got because of the flash flood, if I had stayed there, we would have had 1 cup of coffee. She would have added water to those same grounds, rebrewed it, we would have had a second, slightly weaker cup. Then she would have added water and had a 3rd cup. Throughout Ethiopia, coffee is called buna, no matter what language or dialect you speak. It's a variation of buna. It's one of the reasons why they've realized that this is the genetic home to coffee, is because of that association. Throughout Ethiopia, when you're having the coffee in those three-stage ritual, each of those stages can mean different things. In Kele, if you show up during the 1st cup of coffee, if you're an unwed woman and some stranger man walks across your threshold, you're going to marry him. That's what happens during the 1st cup of coffee. During the 2nd cup of coffee, it means you're met with suspicion. 3rd cup of coffee means peace. Here's my theory about coffee in Ethiopia, and it's a little bit crazy, so work with me for a moment. Every time I go back to Ethiopia, I have to learn how to have 3-cup processes. This is me. I haven't had coffee since 7 in the morning. I told you I speak quickly. I'm pretty fired up as a person. So I'm there and I'm like, I'm going to have to sit here for 3 cups of coffee and all the conversation and then do it again in 3 hours? Like, how am I going to get my life done? How am I going to get my work done? But eventually I remember how to do it. That 3-cup ceremony, in my opinion, is one of the reasons why this country has been one of the most harmonious, why you can have a nation that's 60% Christian and 40% Muslim, and people largely get along. It doesn't mean everyone's shiny, happy people in Ethiopia, but it does mean that people sit down and walk a conversation through to its end, to that 3rd cup of coffee, where it means peace. I think it's something that we can all learn from. You have to have some level of resolution if you're going to sit with someone for an hour and 20 minutes and have coffee and talk about your community. I'm going to end talking about an area of Ethiopia called Harar. It's in eastern Ethiopia. It's the part of Ethiopia that traded coffee first. And the reason I love this story is that I met a man who told me, after I'd been spending years researching coffee in Ethiopia, fully into this book project, he said, "So you're writing about coffee in Ethiopia?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "They don't drink coffee in Ethiopia." And I said, "Well, that's interesting because I've actually been recording stories about that for years, and that's what my whole book is based on, but, you know, fascinating." And he said, "No, no, you have to understand. You have to go to Harar." So I went to Harar, and I realized that there's a strategy of focused cultural use. When you are the part of Ethiopia that started trading coffee, what happens? You realize that if the more coffee you trade, the more money you make. So if you can stop drinking coffee in a conventional way and get creative, then you're going to keep your exports up. So in Harar, they drink tea made from the leaves of a coffee plant, kuti. There are entire rooms in houses in Harar devoted to the storage of these leaves. There are people who drive from the capital, from Addis Ababa, to get to Harar just to get their stash of kuti for that year. But that focused cultural use doesn't end there. In Harar, which is predominantly Muslim, this is considered the fourth holy city of Islam, actually, they have something called Bunasiri that they enjoy during Ramadan, during the 16th and 26th day. So I imagine I'm dressed in fota and headscarf, and I'm invited to the ceremony by these women. And I sit down, and someone brings out this thick porridge of butter and sugar and coffee cherries. And I am hungry. And if there's going to be food in Ethiopia, I'm going to be ready. And if there's butter, I'm even more ready. So here I am, it's like butter and sugar and coffee. I mean, come on, who wouldn't be excited about this? And a pancake. So they have a barley pancake, and on top of it, they pour this porridge, and they hand it to me because I'm the guest. And I excitedly bite into this thing, and suddenly my teeth clang straight together and make a noise. And these women start laughing at me. And I look at it, and I'm like, well, what is this? I take another bite, and my teeth shoot straight through it. I'm expecting this to be kind of a cooked red coffee cherry. So I'm thinking it's going to be hard to chew, and that's how I'm biting into it. I'm like ready, like I'm biting into a nut. Instead, there's nothing in it. It's empty. And I look at these women, and I say, it's empty. And they say, yeah, it's empty. And I said, no, it's empty. And they said, yes, it's empty. Well, it turns out that I'm saying empty, which is waber, and waber in Arabic means empty. So we're saying the same thing back and forth to each other, but not realizing that we're meaning different things by it. And I'm fascinated by this. And I'm jacked up on sugar because I've had about 10 bites of this at this point. And it's just this thick porridge. And I look at one of the women, Waziro Fatima, and I said, you have to show me what these beans are. Why is there an empty bean? What happened to the seed? So I follow her to her house. Harar is an ancient walled city. It's the kind of place that you want to leave a trail of breadcrumbs, because even though it's only a mile in any direction to get out of this thing, you could get lost in there for your entire life. We're weaving through courtyards and people's living rooms and bathrooms and animal stars and a beautiful garden, and suddenly we get to Waziro Fatima's house. And she's somewhat elderly and somewhat small, and she runs over to this giant 10-gallon kind of sack. And she leans over to pick it up, and I think, oh, God, she's going to throw her back. And I'm like, no, no, let me. And she leans over, and she throws it over her head, and she says, waber, waber, it's empty. It's full of, like, popcorn beans. And I dig my hands in there, I pick them up, and they're empty. These are holy beans, she explains to me. These are the beans that are first fall off the tree. So I take some, and I'm feeling amazingly special until I realize that all over Harar, these are sold at the market. But I'm still feeling special because Waziro Fatima gave me hers. And a couple weeks later, I'm at the head research station for coffee in Jima, Ethiopia, so in the central highlands in the coffee area. And I show these beans to one of the head researchers, and I say, so tell me the story. What are these? And he says, these are sick beans. And I said, but they're holy. That's what Waziro Fatima told me, is that they're holy. And he said, no, these are diseased. I am never going to go to Waziro Fatima and tell her that her holy beans are diseased. That is a conversation I am not having when I go give her a copy of this book, because that would be awkward and unfortunate. But, depending on how you look at it, it depends on where you live in Ethiopia. Harar has this amazing history of coffee. But one of the things that Harar also has is the biggest problem presented to Ethiopia right now, chaat. Chaat is a hallucinogenic drug. It's a mild narcotic, and it's grown, chaat, cat, it's called a bunch of different things, There's actually a debate as to whether or not chaat is from Ethiopia, and a lot of people say that chaat's from Yemen and coffee's from Ethiopia, and that they both try to claim the cultural heritages of either or, but now that's supposedly more established. The thing about chaat is this landscape here, which looks beautiful, it looks sort of like the Tuscan highlands. This used to be filled with century-old coffee trees, lush, forested, tons of birds, tons of shade, and now it's just a bunch of short, squat shrubs of chaat. It looks kind of cool. It looks like, wow, there's some great agriculture going on here. But then you realize what they're growing, and you realize that the effect of chaat on the soil is that it renders it completely acidic, so nothing else can grow there. So basically, you're putting a cash crop in that people are constantly harvesting. Chaat's best and most potent when it's fresh. So there are Isuzu trucks running all over Ethiopia delivering this stuff to get on planes to go to Djibouti, Brussels, London, the States, depending on who you ask, going to the also the head of Ethiopia in Addis. And what that does is it's changing the economy of eastern Ethiopia. I've seen pictures of this landscape where all you have is lush coffee trees, and now you have none of that. What is Ethiopia going to do about that? Ethiopia is not immune to tough situations. 1984, there was the other famine happening in Ethiopia. Everyone in this room was alive then. So what do we all remember about the global response to the 1984 famine? Initially, it was pathetic. Yeah. Kind of ignoring it. Yeah, thank you. What else? That's the We Are the World. That's Live Aid, Band-Aid. Yep. So all these amazing musicians came together to do this outcry for Ethiopia, right? Cyndi Lauper, Lionel Richie, Michael Jackson, the whole crew. I was 8. I lived in Minneapolis. I went to a Montessori school where any global event that was happening, we did a big, huge campaign about. And so I was so moved by what was happening in Ethiopia at that point that I wrote my own song in response to Michael Jackson. This is it.
I want to help a kid in Ethiopia. Nobody else can help this one.
You can fully laugh because it's really bad.
Everybody needs somebody to care for them. But some people don't even cry about them.
Here's the chorus. Everyone will have in their head for the rest of the night. That song goes on for 3.5 minutes. I like to remind people it was 1984, okay? This is a ballad. I am warbling my voice the best I can. And I used to show that song a couple years ago when I talked about Ethiopia, and I took it out of talks recently. But then, when I was back in Africa this past fall, when that photo is from me giving the book to Otto Schale, I realized that I'm trying to have a conversation with people, and I'm saying, let's get beyond the famine. Let's move ourselves into a more rounded perspective of Ethiopia. And I realized that I was lying if I didn't admit how strong that image of drought, famine, and poverty is still in my heart and in my gut. Because when I was back there, I realized that you can't just cure yourself of it. You can't just pretend that you don't see it. You have to actually acknowledge the fact that you're still struggling with shaking that loose. Ethiopia created much of the paradigm of current world aid. After Live Aid, after Michael Jackson, unfortunately my song didn't have as much traction as We Are the World, but we're trying to make that change. After Michael Jackson came out with that, it changed the landscape of aid. Ethiopia kind of led the way. Everything that's wonderful about the way aid was done in the 80s and the 90s and everything that's horrible was all happening in Ethiopia. But here's the thing. What if this country could be the country that leads the way to revision the way aid is happening? The way aid is now development. The way you have foreign investment. Ethiopia has that potential. Again, I'm not saying there are not problems there. But you have some of the smartest, some of the people who have the most experience with development centered in that part of East Africa. There's a lot of amazing stuff happening. And there's even more amazing stuff if we give it the chance. The opportunity is there. The last story I'm going to tell you tonight is about Asnakich Thomas. Asnakhij is a woman who's sort of the touchstone for a lot of my coffee stories. And that's because I've gotten to know her pretty well over the past couple years. And Asnakhij and I were talking one night, and she was telling me this story about how when she was a young child, she was kidnapped at 12 and taken away from her family, forced to marry, had two children by the time she was 14. She escaped, was caught. She escaped again and was caught. The third time she escaped all the way to the capital, to Addis, to kind of like a day and a half drive right now. So subtract 40 years. It took her about 3 months to get to Addis Ababa. She lived there during the end of Haile Selassie's reign. She lived there during the Derg, during the Red Terror, during some horrible things that were happening in Ethiopia. She finally left. She moved to London. She lived in England, and she started making cheese and getting into animal husbandry and making wedding cakes. This woman has done so many things with her life. But the one thing that she still wants to do is she wants to build a hospital for the women of Kele, the village where she grew up. She's returned there, and she's started to have two coffee mills in this region. And the reason she's doing this is because she feels that when the women in Kele have complicated childbirth, they have to travel 150 kilometers to the nearest hospital. And when they do, they normally come home two in a box. Asnakhij told me this, and I was taking notes, and I was nodding, and I've known her long enough to know that, like, when Asnakhij talks, you just nod. You just want her to keep pouring on these stories. She's a beautiful, beautiful storyteller. And I looked up at her, and I said, two in a box? She said, mother and child together, both dead, one coffin. Coffee can change this. Those are not my words. Those are Asnakhij's words. She believes that if her green gold, if her coffees, if her nation's coffees can get more attention, then it can change the economics. She's so determined about this. And I have no doubt that this woman is going to build a hospital for the women of Kele, and it's going to happen soon. I'm an optimist. I think that we all want to have deeper connections with the world. I think we can do it through coffee. I think that coffee, as I said, whether you drink it, whether you're surrounded by it, can be a reminder to let things be a little bit more complicated. I think it's how we deepen the human conversation. So if you are an individual and you want to know what to do now, how do you move away from this conversation and go change the world through coffee? Ask questions. Ask questions about the coffee you're drinking. Will there be answers? It depends on who you're asking. But by you asking those questions, you're going to change the dialogue. That's what you can do with coffee. You can try to find the stories, the cultural stories, not just coffee farmers deserve more because they're poor. Let's move away from poverty. Let's go to possibility. It's a heck of a lot better place to be. Then, in your own life, if you work with a company, there are amazing sustainable nonprofits working in East Africa right now, and I can guarantee you there's one that is aligned with your vision and would love for you to partner with it in any way, shape, or form. And in your own life, if you can walk away from tonight and be willing to have some more three-cup conversations, move towards complexity. It doesn't have to be about Africa. It doesn't have to be about coffee. But sit in the middle. Wiggle your tooth a little bit. If you're going to lose them again, don't wiggle them too much. But wiggle your mental teeth and see what comes out of it. We're living in a complex world. We're complex people. Let's embrace it. Let's use this to do that. Thanks. So I'd like to invite you all to ask questions, and I'm supposed to tell you you're supposed to come to the microphone, and I also want to make an announcement that Travis Horn, who took the amazing photos in this book, just walked in, and he'll wave, and I haven't seen Travis since we were in Ethiopia together, and he lives in the area, so. Would you mind coming to the microphone? Otherwise, I'll get in trouble from the club. Uh-oh. Is it on?
So... Okay.
Yes, wonderful.
So I have attention deficit. So as I was listening to you, I got distracted when you talked about a goat.
And that will happen.
And I wandered off, because this was agricultural, I wandered off to the goat's horn, because this is the horn of Africa. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about what that horn should be filled with, the cornucopia. And I was thinking to myself, and this is my question, is coffee, why is the agriculture so limited? Is part of my question. The other is, should that cornucopia be filled with more than coffee? Water seemed very important to me, mm-hmm. and the use of water, because you talked about the woman and her child. Mm-hmm. I would have listed water as the first priority of the country, mm-hmm. Because of health. And the other is the question of diversity of agriculture.
Great questions. I think that you are absolutely right, that ultimately people need to be fed in Ethiopia. They need to have safe water. They need to have access to medical care. Coffee is not the thing that's going to solve everything in Ethiopia, but coffee is the way that we all have a tactile resonance with Ethiopia. So it's one thing to say, let's all make sure that people have clean drinking water in Ethiopia, but that pushes it away from like what our daily reality is. So I think that if we can have a daily reality reminder, then that can also help us advocate for other things that are going to encourage that. I think that there can be a big diversity of crops. Sesame crops are doing great in Ethiopia. The leather industry is pretty incredible in Ethiopia. They have more livestock than any other country in Africa. But I think that coffee, because of what it does for the environment, because it creates shade trees, it creates bird habitats, it changes the way the animals are, it's a crop that's been there and been very successful. So I think that any conversation, if it's already been a coffee-growing land, should include that. Thank you for that.
What a wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
Your enthusiasm is infectious. Thank you very much. This really follows on the previous question, in that there is diversification. In fact, near Arba Minch, there are a lot of foreigners who own significant property growing citrus and, mm-hmm. and other crops. And there's a lot of concern within Ethiopia that the government is giving away land that is theirs, and concern that their water is, in fact, being taken away. Mm-hmm. Are there, in fact, foreigners who are involved in coffee today, and to what extent?
There are a lot of foreigners involved in coffee, and they've been involved in coffee for a long time, whether it's a small boutique coffee company like Blue Bottle here in the Bay Area, whether it's a large conglomerate like Starbucks, whether it's entrepreneurs, people even today who've heard these stories and say, I want to go help these farmers tell better stories about their coffee. There's quite a bit of activity from foreigners in the coffee world, and there's also a lot of Ethiopians who are getting stronger and stronger in the marketing of their coffee. I think that it's a big question to Ethiopia right now. How are they going to move forward? Are they going to still have the coffee be Ethiopian, or are they going to cede rights to some of those foreign companies? Can they have partnerships? Can it be more constructive so that the two are working together? That's obviously the ideal. I think that's at least the projection that most people are saying that they want. I like to think the best of people. I'd like to think that, let's say, 85% of them really mean it. And I think that that's where there can be a lot of potential. I mean, the reality is that Ethiopia, here's the irony, right? In the 70s and the 80s, when the Derg controlled Ethiopia, communist, socialist, Marxist, that's when everybody else was getting really industrialized. So that's when places like Brazil were just having massive coffee farms that they could just go pick with machines. But Ethiopia, communist, is not going to have a massive coffee farm. That's the benefit of Ethiopia now, because there's all of these micro lots that you can preserve. So it's this wonderful gift of that horrible time in Ethiopian history that now it can kind of rise and have all of those different flavors. It maintained the genetic diversity because of what happened, ironically, in the government standpoint. So I think there's really good potential.
This is related to that. So the New Yorker a couple weeks ago had an article about a coffee farmer. I believe she was in El Salvador. Mm-hmm. And it was all about her taking over her father's farm, mm-hmm. and moving it from, like, the cheapest bottom of the coffee market to, like, some of the most expensive coffee in the world, like, yep. getting into the market of Stumptown and Four Barrel and Blue Bottle and all yep. those buyers that mm-hmm. are doing really sort of expensive buying, and like she does special harvesting of her coffee beans and things like that to mm-hmm. differentiate them from the bulk coffee market. And so I was wondering, I mean, I think that that's happening in Ethiopia as well. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on it, and like ways that that's a good way to be going, ways that could be problematic. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, I'm kind of like a policy person. So I'm like, okay, well, what's the policy takeaway? Like, is there stuff that the government of Ethiopia should be doing. Is there, like, infrastructure missing? Like, the roads aren't used, so, like, seems like the roads should be used, but you seem to think that big industrialization of coffee farms, like in Brazil, maybe wouldn't be best for, like, your small landowner. So, yeah, I guess I'm just curious, like, what are you advocating for us to do other than, like, think a little bit more about this stuff?
So let's back up, because that was about 7 questions in one. So so in terms of what's happening in Ethiopia in terms of small-scale lot cultivation, a lot is happening there. So let's say that all of us live in the same neighborhood, and there happens to be this unique coffee tree there that produces a coffee that, if you keep it on its own all the way through the process, has a different flavor profile. That flavor profile is something worth preserving because people have determined that it's worth more money. That's happening a lot in Ethiopia. And the thing is that Ethiopia a couple years ago started a commodities exchange, and it actually really complicated things because they had all these companies working with these farmers and saying, great, let's make this special. And then the commodities exchange came and it said, let's just throw it all in a vat. That basically put everything behind a couple years. But what happened is there's this outcry from the world of coffee companies saying, what the heck did you just do? We've been working with Ethiopia for 10 years to get this thing rainforest certified. And so now the government has gone and started the specialty coffee arm and said, okay, we're not going to do that anymore, which is great that it actually went through that whole process with it. And I don't think industrialization is bad. But I was using the example that it's this gift that instead of industrializing in the 70s and 80s, we can do it now and do it right. So instead of saying, let's just mow it all down and homogenize it, when they used to release the strains of coffee to grow around Ethiopia when the Central Jima Research Station did, for 10 years they released beans that didn't grow in the region that they sent the beans to because they would find these great beans that were from Harar and then they'd send them to Jima and they'd turn out to be horrible coffee. Now they understand that it has to be region specific. So that's the time. This is a great time to kind of use that education. I think that doing that is really important, but I also think that the large-scale coffee is equally important. I think that we can have an idealistic notion that it's from the small growers, from the micro boutiques who sell it, that that's going to change the world. And we were talking about it earlier up here that you have to have the buy-in from the big companies too, and that we can't be completely against those companies because they have massive buying power. So it's about having the concert of the two of them. So when you say, what can we do besides thinking more complicated, it goes back to saying, I want a story with my coffee. I want to know where it came from. I want transparency. And it doesn't mean they have to sit down every time you have a cup of coffee and listen to someone tell you a 30-minute story about, you know, the woman in El Salvador who has 7 kids. And I mean, you know, that's going to be complicated for all of us. But I think that what you can do is you can say, where is this coming from? What does it mean? How are you honoring its origins? Because I think what that does is it shakes loose that connection to culture, that connection to land in a way that I think that we can really value. And, you know, ultimately, for coffee to make a move, there are going to be coffees that get an incredible amount of money a pound. But once that happens, the trickle down into what the cup of coffee is that's from a large conglomerate that's crystallized in some cup, that's eventually going to change, too. So you have to have the super highbrow to have the middle of the road. I mean, it's all these kind of every engine needs to be going at the same time. And then lastly, you asked about the government. I knew there was one more. So what the government is doing now is, I think, trying to face up to a pretty big challenge. Because when you have a government that's been run mainly in a communist system that's now in the free market, there's a lot of hold-ons, like the way export processes work. So right now, there are a lot of entrepreneurs. I personally think that if, you know, every month 20 new entrepreneurs could go to Ethiopia and get their hands dirty in the coffee world, I think it would be fabulous. I would love it. Because there are infrastructure things that can change, but it has to be done from within Ethiopia. It's its own country. It's the way of doing things. But yet, we can't just say, oh, that's Ethiopia. That's the way it's done. It's like, you know what? This can be done better. Let's figure out how to do it. Let's work in harmony. And I think that, you know, it's still a relatively new place for people to dig into, and the people who've done it have been really successful. But I think, I mean, 10,000 types of coffee, let's get 10,000 entrepreneurs in there and say, let's do it. Let's build some brands. Let's have some awareness. Let's change the way this is done. Are there other questions?
I have a question. So you said you lead.
You're the one who said.
I know. You said you lead tours to Ethiopia. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So I've been working with Imagine One Day, a sustainable education nonprofit. And I go there, and what we do is that we get people to try to have a bigger, more robust view of Ethiopia. So instead of like a Habitat for Humanity model where you just go and you build one home or one school, you actually are touring Ethiopia to all these different projects that they're working in, and then I take you to the coffee lands, or we go rock climbing, we go mountain biking. And the idea is for people to have this nuanced vision of Ethiopia. And there's actually information about Imagine One Day up here, which I got to say, I've been involved with them for 4 years, and I've never met an organization that works at the transparent level that they do, that works with students. And I've just seen these communities where they did not have primary schools before, and now when we go in to have a meeting, the entire community, 400 people, grandmothers, grandfathers, show up to have conversations about what they want their kids to have in their schools. They have art classes. They have physical education. It's pretty profound. And they also have increased female enrollment by 70% in their schools. So it's pretty phenomenal, and I'm really honored to work with them there. And I'm also organizing the first ever trail race in Ethiopia. So in those mountains that I was doing the rock climbing in, I realized it's really better to hike there and to run. So we're doing actually the first ever trail race that's going to happen in December. We're right now soliciting corporate partners, and we're going to have some of the amazing runners of Ethiopia, people like Geber Meriam, who won the New York Marathon last year. Haile Gebrselassie is going to do some training with us. And then elite North American runners, all competing with up-and-coming Ethiopian runners on a half-mile rugged trail race. So that's really cool, and part of it's going to be benefiting a new school and then also doing eye care work. I work with a group that does curable blindness, so it's pretty amazing. They do eye camps where they cure 1,000 people of blindness in a week. So that's what people are going to be able to participate in. So if anyone has ideas of companies they think should be behind it, come grab me, because that's the stage we're at right now. So it's pretty fun. Yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you for telling that story. And now the concern is about chat.
Uh-huh.
Is there any way we can make coffee more valuable than chat so that it takes over? Chat is taking over right now. So
I think that chat is taking over in the east, but in the mountain highlands, it's too far away. So the infrastructure question is like chat. It's too far to get the chat from the highlands to the port. So the chat goes bad because you need to consume it within 48 hours. So that's a really good thing for coffee. But I think that ultimately for them to go head-to-head economically, there are going to have to be some changes. Chat is going to either have to become, you know, it's effectively legal in Ethiopia. So like what you can do there, can you do subsidies for coffee? What can you move around with? But I think that the best story I can tell you about that is that there's a little village called Goletcha, which is sort of halfway between Harar and Addis. And they had moved towards chop production. They had all, like, you know, started clear-cutting their coffee forests. And then a year later, their coffee prices, they realized they were going up because of what had happened in the global market where people were paying more attention to these unique coffees. And they started getting more money. And so what do? They stopped clear-cutting their coffee trees. That is a singular example, but I will hold on to it till the day I die because it means that you can go in that other direction. And I think that if we can encourage that by valuing that, then we're winning. One more question. Look at that.
Thank you. And I tell you what my question is going to be. But I want to make a comment, too. But my question is, I was fortunate enough to be in Ethiopia for a couple months about a year ago, and I heard the story about the goat and the shepherd, and he took the beans to the monks, and then, you know, life goes on from there. So you indicated that that's the history of coffee in Ethiopia is much longer. And I'd be interested in to know, you know, as much as you know about the origins, because the goat story is pretty persuasive. But I do want to say that everything positive you said about Ethiopia is true. I went there for a week and stayed for 2 months. Mm. It was an extraordinary place to visit, from the farthest north down to the Omo Valley, mm-hmm. where the coffee is also very good. The one thing I do want to say, you mentioned something about the educational system. And I just happened to be looking through my photos this afternoon. There were primary schools down in the Omo Valley, which is as far removed from Western standards as you could imagine people to be living. You probably could not imagine people to be living. The primary schools were run by people, the principals and the teachers, that were so committed to excellence in education. I was astonished. I was blown away by the efforts they made to educate their children with, you know, paintings on the walls, about the periodic tables, about the ocular design of the, and these were primary school kids. Yeah. And I would talk to the principals, and these are men, they were almost always men, who could probably make 10 times as much if they were tour guides, easily 10 times as much. But they instead wanted to work in the educational system to improve their chances for the children. So mm-hmm. I can't say enough about that. It's something I did not see anywhere else in anywhere I've traveled. But I am interested in the origins of the coffee. If I can't tell the goat story, I
you
do
gotta
need
have
a
new story?
I do need a goat story.
Well, what about Prophet Muhammad's grandsons? Do you like? I mean, it's hard to compete with a goat. For some reason, people really like goats. They're cute. They're weird. I mean, they're kind of like persnickety. They come in your house and eat weird things. But, you know, pardon? They're good eating, too. I mean, it's one of the central things you eat in Ethiopia. What I can tell you is, A, buy the book, and B, B, there are so, I mean, there are other fanciful tales, like the ox, like Prophet Muhammad's grandson. When you go back in the history of where the coffee kind of started, what you end up finding out is that, you know, coffee, it really has to trace back from the trading routes, because the first time it showed up was in the 6th century. So that's when you can kind of start it factually. So stories that go back to the Queen of Sheba, those are really hard to prove on a factual basis, just like anything with the Queen of Sheba is relatively hard to prove on a factual basis, which is a bummer. So, you know, what there are is like a lot of murky tales pre-6th century with it. But there's a wonderful paper. So one of the reasons I got into writing this book is that when I went to Ethiopia the first time, I realized that no one had captured these cultural stories. So here's a country that's the birthplace of coffee, and there's tons of research done on yield, drought reduction, but no one was doing the anthropological study of stories that are dying out. And I was sort of horrified that that was my job. I'm like, I don't have a right to do this. I don't live in Ethiopia. I'm not Ethiopian. But I was like, all right, I'm game for it. And the one paper that had been written about this before was by Rita Pankhurst, who's an amazing writer, and she's married to the very famous historian Richard Pankhurst, whose mother, Sylvia Pankhurst, was a big part of sort of the suffragette movement in London and was sort of part of Haile Selassie's court, more or less, and there's a lot of history with her. But Rita set out to write a research story on debunking the myths of some of these origins, and it's fascinating, and I'd be happy to send you a copy of it. I have it as a PDF, and it's really, you know, I relied on it quite a bit, and it was really fascinating to see kind of where these things hold traction and where they disappear. And you can watch, I mean, there are great tales. One of the things I really love is how coffee was used for energy for hunters. So they would make balls of coffee with butter, and then they'd store them in their pockets in leather, and then they'd eat them as they traveled. There's also a story of the first time that they actually realized they could brew coffee was that they had coffee and it was trampled on by camels, and something about the trampling caused enough heat that it sparked, and then it all of a sudden brewed it and people smelled that. So it usually has something to do with the smell of coffee and what it inspires people to do. So, but there are some great stories. But definitely I can give you my card, and I'd love to send you, if you're interested, the paper by Rita is pretty phenomenal too.
Get the book first.
Get the book first, though. Yeah, thanks. Thank you.